The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She knows everything you do because the woman in your life is you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Women's Spaces. My name is Elaine B. Holtz, and I'm your host. And with me at the board is my friend, my partner, my engineer, and my co-producer, Ken Norton. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
Oh, I'm just so excited. Hey, listen, I have a special announcement. I mean, today is the last month, the last day of April. Where did April go? I mean, I just seemed like it was a flash. Well, today we do the Women's Spaces Pledge, but also I have two observers in the studio from Boyle Heights, California. That's my old stomping ground. Actually, I was born, I call it East L.A. And I have Martha Pileo and her partner, Alex Salazar, here. They're observing in the show, and they are also going to do the pledge with us. They're here in support of candidate John Mutz, who's running for sheriff here in Sonoma County. Well, I have two special guests with me this morning. Joining me on the phone will be Francisca Carranza. She's a union representative for Unite Here, Local 2850, the East and North Bay's union for hotel, food service, and gaming work people. We'll be talking about May 1st. And also, I'm really excited, joining me in the studio is Lauren Mendelson, who is an associate attorney at the law offices of Omar Figueroa. And we're going to talk about some of the cannabis laws and what's going on in our county and in Northern California. So it's promises to be a great, great show. A special shout out, happy birthday to my daughter Susan, who had her birthday on Saturday. Hard to believe my baby is going to be a grandmother. I guess that makes me a great grandmother. Also, I found out we're going to be having a little girl. What a blessing. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to be a great grandmother. Definitely an inspiration for me to keep on keeping on and to try to instill ideas, thoughts, and inspiration to hopefully have some sort of peace on this earth. Anyway, the baby's name is good. We found out. I mean, what a modern age we live in. I remember when I was pregnant, I mean, I had to wait 9 months until I found out what the baby was. But right now, we get that. We have science that gives us all that information. So I have a special announcement. It's a healthy baby girl. Her name is going to be, I can't believe this name, Satori Trinity Jensen. I know we're going to call her Tori, but Satori Trinity Jensen. And she's expected to join us around September 9th. I mean, I'm so excited. I mean, I look in the mirror and I say to myself, wow, you know, grandmother, now great-grandmother, and your own daughter's going to be a grandmother. Now I know how my mother felt when she became a grandmother and knew that I was going to be a mother. Oh, just amazing. Well, a shout-out to some really hard-working folks, the Independent Office of Law Enforcement Review and Outreach, IALERO. It was established by the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors on September 15, 2015. IALERO was born out of the tragic shooting and killing of a 13-year-old boy by Sheriff Deputy Eric Gelhaus, young Andy Lopez, in 2013. They will be hosting a candidates forum, and it's tonight. It's tonight with the three candidates for sheriff. I urge folks to attend. You know, many of us, what ends up happening, we get these flyers in the mail, right? One after another, and nobody ever asks, where does the money come from? You know, why so many flyers sometime and so little flyers other times? The most important thing, particularly with the sheriff's race, this is the first time in over 30 years that we actually here in Sonoma County have a choice. So folks have got to come out to the event tonight. It's going to be at the Veterans Memorial in downtown Santa Rosa. Let's see if we got the address here. April 30th, Santa Rosa Veterans Memorial Building at 1351 Maple Avenue in Santa Rosa. It's going to be happening between 6:30 and 8:30 p.m. And also, there's another important event coming up by another very strong group in our in our county, the North Bay Organizing Project, and they're going to be hosting the sheriff's event, and that's going to be this Friday, May 4th. It's hosted by the North Bay Organizing Project, and also Rapid Response and Petaluma Indivisible. You know, really, folks in Petaluma, you got to get out there. You got to meet these folks. You know, a flyer does not tell you the personality of a person. A flyer is just like a propaganda piece, but when you're there and you get to feel the people, you get to understand them, you get to hear them, and you get to ask questions. I found out from the Iolero Candid Forum, they got 90 questions. So people are really involved. So there's going to be a very exciting event, and it's also going to be somewhat of a debate. It's just going to be a little bit different. And also, we're going to be talking with Francisca Carranza, and she's also going to be talking about International Workers' Day, which is also known as Labor's Day or Workers' Day in some countries, and often referred to as May Day. It's a celebration of laborers and the working class that is promoted by the International Labor Movement, which occurs every year. And as I've said many, many times, my father was a union man. And, you know, it was really interesting. One time I was talking to him, and I said, Dad, why are you so adamant about being part of the union? And he said to me, he said, I never met a boss that was willing to give me a raise without a struggle. You know, so that's why unions are very, very important. Well, May Day started in 1886. With more than 300,000 workers in 13,000 businesses across the United States walked off their jobs in the first May Day celebration in history in Chicago. You know what they were walking off for? An 8-hour day. You know, we forget that our 8-hour day, our vacation pay, some of our benefits, all the things, safety in the workplace. Safety in the workplace. I mean, you go to work, you could be locked in for hours, and you had no say-so, you had no voice. But when the unions formed, that was the first time that workers actually had a voice. You know, unions create a sense of freedom for us. And here in Santa Rosa, we're going to have tomorrow, there's going to be a march and a rally at 2 o'clock. Everyone begins to gather at the Dollar Tree parking lot on Sebastopol Road. That actually is called the Roseland Village Neighborhood Center now. It's 17 Sebastopol Road. People are going to start gathering at 2 o'clock. Between 2:30 and 3:30 will be a rally with many organizations and speakers presenting. At 3:30, that we're going to march to the Hyatt Hotel on 3rd Street. And then after the rally, people are going to gather down in downtown Santa Rosa and have another rally, and they're also going to be talking about the homeless situation. You know, I read the other day that there's a little bit of a reprieve as far as getting people off the lot over in Roseland. So people need to show up. That's going to be tomorrow. Excuse me. Yes, tomorrow, May 1st. Oh, my God, I can't believe it's May 1st. Anyway, starts at 2 o'clock, and if you go on www.womenspaces, everything will be there. Well, as everybody knows, this is the last Monday of the month. So what do? We do the Women's Spaces Pledge. And I'm so excited because I have 5 people are going to do the pledge with me. So I'm going to invite my guest here to join me, and also you can join me also if you like. So let's start with the pledge. You know, the pledge, I need to give everybody a little reminder. You know, what's so interesting? I wrote the pledge for my grandson Ryan. And it's so interesting. He's going to become a father. I mean, I can't believe he was a little boy. He came off from his daycare center, and he started crying. And I said, Ryan, what's the matter? And he says, my teacher said I'm a bad boy. And I said, what? She says, I'm not going to be anything. I says, you're not going to be anything. I says, Ryan, your self-esteem does not depend on her. It depends on your relationship with yourself. And that's how we developed the pledge. And every time I picked him up, we would say it. And when he graduated Santa Cruz, he's coming down the hill, and he goes, Grandma, and he's recited the pledge, and it was just a moment that I will never forget. So this is a very, very important saying to me, and I hope to my listeners out there that it's also something important to them. Because, you know, as women, in order for us to stand up, we have to have self-esteem. And self-esteem is a lifetime challenge. Trust me, I know. I'm 78 years old. I've been struggling with it from the day that I was born. Anyway, let's do the pledge together. What I'd like to tell my guest here in the studio is I will say the first lines and you repeat after me. And I notice Alex, he's got his hand raised. I like that, his right hand. He's really making the pledge. So here we go. First line, and then you repeat after me, and then we'll go through the whole thing together.
My self-esteem
does not depend
on anything
outside of me.
My self-esteem
depends
on my relationship
with myself
and my higher power.
Oh, God, that just gives me the chills. You know, what's so interesting is, you know, I say the pledge once a month, but I say it every single day. And I say it about four or five times before I come on the air. So I'm going to say it, and let's just say it together. It's kind of, let's lift our voices as loud as we can. So let's go. One, two, three. My self-esteem does not depend on anything outside of me. My self-esteem depends on my relationship with myself and my higher power. Wow. Boy, everybody, that really sounds great. Well, thank you all so much for saying that. And I'm going to say it one more time to my listeners. You know, remember, my self-esteem does not depend on anything outside of me. My self-esteem depends on my relationship with myself and my higher power. You know, oftentimes people say, what do you mean by higher power? Well, I used to say whatever or woohoo, but I thought higher power, like this energy, you know, right now, I'm watching my roses bloom. Well, that's the higher power. You know, God, it's just nature and all the different things that go on around us and just the fact that we were born. So there has to be something greater than us. So I call it my higher power. Well, that's a lot to chew on, but that's what Women's Spaces is all about. It's for women to start thinking, to start standing up, to start speaking out, and not be afraid to be who they are. Well, time goes by fast, and we're going to take a musical break right now. And then after we come back, we're going to be on the phone with Francisca Carranza, and we're going to be talking about unions. And so I picked this great, great song by Beverly Grant. I love Beverly Grant. She's a singer that I just found recently, and she does a lot of political songs. And this is a great union song, Whose Side Are You On? That's a big question. Whose side are we on? You know, are we on the side of war? Or are we on the side of peace? Are we on the side of love? Or are we on the side of hate? You know, are we on the side on workers' rights? Or are we on the side of slavery? I mean, start thinking about it. So whose side are you on? So let's listen to Whose Side Are You On with Beverly Grant. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Francisca Carranza.
Which side are you on? 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 Come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell. How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 We're starting off. Why? Which side are you on? 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 Workers, can you stand it? Tell me how you can. Or will you be a lousy scab or take a union stand? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Don't scare before the bosses, don't listen to their lies.
Yes, which side are you on? I know what side I'm on. I'm on the union side. Anyway, for folks just joining us, you are listening to KBBF 89.1 FM Calistoga. I want to remind my listeners that the opinions expressed here are not necessarily the opinions of KBBF, its board of directors, its members, or Women's Spaces. Well, welcome back. You're listening to Women's Spaces, and I'm your host, Elaine B. Holt. And without further ado, I want to introduce my first guest on the phone with me is Francisca Carranza. Welcome, Francisca. Welcome to Women's Spaces.
Thank you, Elaine, for having me here.
Oh, your voice sounds. Come just a little bit closer and talk just a little bit louder. Is that okay?
That's okay.
There we go. Francisca, let me tell my listeners a little bit about you. Is that okay?
That's okay.
Francisca Carranza is a union representative for Unite Here, Local 2850, the East and North Bay's union for hotel, food service, and gaming workers. Local 2850 is also part of United Here, the international union which represents workers throughout the United States and Canada working in the hospitality, gaming, food servicing, manufacturing, textile, laundry, and airport industries. Wow, Francisca, that's a lot. She's a leading organizer that came to the fight for workers' dignity during the historic Castlewood, Pleasantwood, California lockout that kept 61 members locked out and off the job for more than 30 months. You know, Francisca, I remember my father when he was on strike. To her credit, she organized the non-union workers at Grayton Casino and other North Bay communities. Francisca, I don't know how you do it. Francisca is the mother of six children, an immigrant from Tijuana, Baja California, Mexico. She moved to the United States searching for economic opportunity. Well, welcome, my love. Welcome to Women's Spaces.
Thank you, Lynn, for having me here.
Well, let's start out. Let's talk a little bit. How did you get involved in union organizing, and what were some of your challenges? I mean, here you are a woman, you know, and you have six children. You know, what were some of your challenges, and how did you get involved?
Well, I got involved. I came to work at Castlewood Country Club, and this is a golf club, private golf club, that is in Pleasanton, California. And I started working there in 2008 as a janitor. Pretty soon, we had to renew our contract because this place had been union for 30 years prior to my arriving there. In 2009, our contract expired. So we were negotiating for a new contract. There was a lot of changes in that club. You know, the board of directors changed, and they thought that they needed to make more money, right? And so they decided that the workers, the only way to make more money was to reduce the workers' benefits.
Oh,
and
wow.
So workers in that club had free medical benefits. They had paid lunch. They had paid vacation. They had a lot of things. And so they decided that the workers could pay $739 for family health coverage a month, from having it free to paying $739 a month. If you do a little bit of math, at $12 an hour, you will have to basically leave a two-week check just for the insurance at that time. And it was impossible to do. So the workers, of course, did not agree to that. They wanted to do a variety of things, pick and choose who would work, you know, having the most attractive people in front of, you know, the guests, mostly men at this time, and having, you know, the less attractive people, sending them home or working in the back of the house. There was a lot of discrimination, inequality. And so we weren't going to stand for that, right? The union was 100%, the union organizers were 100% behind us. And so we decided not to accept that. To force us to accept their conditions, they locked us out. So they couldn't fire us, but they could close the doors. And so that's what they did. So we were out, all of a sudden, we were out on the streets, you know, fighting for our rights, fighting for our health care, fighting for our benefits, and fighting for our dignity, right? Because they told us that we were a bunch of Mexicans and that we couldn't that we couldn't fight, right? That we didn't have a ride. They didn't want us there.
Francisco, let me just ask you a quick question. Where did you get your confidence? I mean, where all of a sudden here you're new to this country and all of a sudden you're confronted this. Where did you get your confidence?
No, the confidence came years before that, because I was a victim of domestic violence. I had zero confidence. I have zero self-esteem. And I managed to survive that, escape from that. And when I had to look after my kids and look after myself, you know, in a non-friendly world, when I discovered that I could do it, that I could, you know, work and support my kids in a way that didn't put me down, I thought, I'm able to do anything. If I can support my kids, I can do anything.
Well, you know, Francisca, I just want to give you a shout out, because that gives me confidence and courage, you know, when I hear you talk, you know. So what was the result? Were you able to get what you wanted?
Yes. So we were out there for 2 years, 7 months, and 17 days, I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
Outside, picketing 10 times a week. You know, twice a day in front of all these members who didn't have anything but insults for us. Most of us were Latino, right? There was a couple of Anglos in there, very strong people. And we had to withstand insults. You know, they were pointing us with their finger. They were telling us to go back home. And by that meant, you know, go back to your country. You're not welcome here. This is my country. And so, you know, pretty soon it was pretty frustrating. You know, we have to talk to each other, the workers, and then say, you know, we're here and we're fighting for our jobs. This is not right. We're not only fighting for our jobs, we're also fighting for our dignities.
Right.
They're not gonna be.
And for your children and for the future, and I mean, to put food on the table, I mean, you know, which brings me to the next point, you know, I mean, here you had this amazing win, and now you're into another struggle, and also under Trump at this time, unions even have a greater challenge. What do you think is happening, and in your words, what do you think is the most important thing about being a union member?
Well, being a union member means that you're not allowing anybody to make decisions for yourself. You know, being a union member signifies that you have rights, that you're a human and that you're going to fight for, you know, injustice, discrimination, inequality. And so I think that's very important, because right now with the president that we have, that, you know, when he's putting people down just because of their color or the way they look, I think we need to stay together and be a force.
Go ahead. Well, anyway, I have to totally agree with you. I mean, the most important thing is people. You know, I realize, you know, one of the things that you said at the beginning is that one of the things that was happening is that you were being discriminated against because you were Mexican. Well, you know, I was born in East L.A., and one of the things that I know about the Mexican people is they're very family oriented, and also, when you don't know somebody, then you make judgments but if we get to know each other and we get to understand that all of our struggles, it's the same struggle. It's a struggle for human dignity, for the right to work, and for the right to have a decent wage. Would you agree with that, Francisca?
I agree with that.
Yes. So, you know, right now, you know, you're organizing the Hyatt here in Santa Rosa, and also we're coming up to May 1st. So can you talk a little bit about what's happening at the Hyatt and also your involvement with the May 1st rally?
Of course. So we represent several hotels across the United States and in Canada. The most dense city we have here in the Bay Area is in San Francisco, where 96% of the hotels are unionized, and the union is very strong. In the North Bay, that density is very small. So we only have two hotels that are union currently, the Petaluma Sheraton and the Graton Casino. And the hotel is under, they're fighting for a contract. They're negotiating a contract. And so the Hyatt was recognized about a year ago. The workers decided that they wanted to be represented by a union, and they fought for it, and the union was recognized. They are since then negotiating for a contract, but the company keeps lagging. You know, they keep pushing. They keep they give us a date for negotiations every 2, every 3 months, and so time has passed by 1 year already, and we haven't gotten anything. But the conditions in this hotel is that in most hotels with union, the workers, the housekeepers, only clean 13, 14, up to 15 rooms. In this hotel, the ladies clean up to 32 rooms every day.
Amazing. Well, you know, time goes by really quickly when you're in the studio here, and I just want to do a shout out. That is amazing that you're organizing. And, you know, one of the things that I learned when I was growing up in a union household is that it just takes so much time. Sometimes you have to scratch your head. You know, I think people forget when they're into management. They forget when they weren't into management and what it was like and that they need to support one another. Well, let's talk a little bit about the May 1st rally. Francisca is coming up tomorrow. And there's going to be a rally in Santa Rosa. Can you talk about that and what your involvement is going to be and why you think people should show up?
Yes, we've been involved with the coalition who's organizing the march, and people have different issues that they want the community to be aware of, right? Immigration, homelessness, gun violence, Palestine, a lot of important issues. But one of the most important ones is the one that hits right home, right? And I think this is the discrimination to workers, or, you know, the way they're being treated. And so we came to the coalition and we say, look, these workers are, you know, being mistreated, and we need your help. We need the community to be aware. A lot of times we have issues happening right where we live, and we're not aware of them, right? We're aware of things going on in Korea, you know, in China, in Egypt, in other places, but we're not aware of things that are going next door. And so we came to the coalition and we asked them, we need help, we need to push this company, we need to make them know that the community is supporting these workers and that we are not going to allow this treatment to continue. And so they agreed. And they agreed that it's very important to protect, you know, our neighbors. And so we asked the community to make a stop in front of the hotel and let them know that we are all going to be watching them and that they better do something and have a contract, a fair contract ready for the workers soon. And so that's what we asked. And so we're going to be being a part of this march. And we're going to do a rally in front of the hotel. I encourage the community to come and support these workers, you know, because they are single mothers. They are elderly people who are working in here. Sometimes it's the only income for a household. And so it's very important to protect them, right, and support them.
Well, I want to just inject something here. It's not only important to support them, but also to recognize that you're fighting for them. You know, you're fighting for their rights. You're fighting for their ability to get a decent wage. You know, people often forget that they have an 8-hour day, or if they have benefits or all the goodies that come when they're working, that that's all the result of many thousands of men and women marching, getting their heads knocked in. I mean, you know, there's so much that goes on. And so you need to support your workers because we're all workers. You know, that's what's so interesting. I don't care how much your salary is, you're still a worker, and you still have to protect your rights. Well, listen, is there any website or anything that folks can get a hold of you?
Yes, they can look up unitehere.org on Facebook and online, and it will give you history, it will give you stories, it will give you a lot of information about our union.
Well, Francisca, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here on Women's Spaces. I want to remind folks that the march is going to be tomorrow. It's going to be starting at 2 o'clock. Everybody's going to gather at the Dollar Tree parking lot, actually called the Roseland Village Neighborhood Center, at 777 Sebastopol Road. At 2:30 to 3:30, there'll be a rally with many organizers speaking. Are you going to be speaking, Francisca?
No, I'd rather have the workers tell their stories in their own words. Well, probably our president is going to speak a little bit about our union.
And it looks like at 3:30, folks, that's when they're going to be marching to the Hyatt Hotel on 3rd Street in Santa Rosa. And then after the rally, people are going to continue to march. They're going to march down to Santa Rosa City Hall. Are there any last words you'd like to share for Francisca before we say goodbye?
Yes. I would like to share that we're really grateful with the community. They have helped us before, supporting a lot of the workers. Don't let this opportunity to support your own pass by. Come and have fun and support these workers. And you know, stop by and say hi and say, hey, I'm here for you. And that's what community does, right? So I hope to see a lot of faces in that march.
I hope to be there and meet you. And Francisca, I want to say one thing. Remember, you're a woman, a mother, a strong force in our community. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being on Women's Spaces and for all that you do. And just many, many blessings to you.
Thank you so much, Elaine, for this opportunity.
You take care and be safe.
I will. Thank you.
Oh, what a story. I mean, you know, we got to realize the unions are what gave us what we have, you know, and, you know, of course, government and all the big boys, they want to say, get rid of the union. No, that's what gives us our right. It gives us our protection. So thank you so much, Francisca Carranza, for having such a beautiful interview. And, you know, she's a woman. You know, we're women first. You know, when people ask me, who are you? I say the first thing is I'm a human being. The second thing, I'm a woman. The third thing, I'm a mother. And anything else you want to call me, that comes afterwards. But these are the three most important things. And it's the women who tend to lead the way in so many issues. Anyway, we are going to take a musical break. And the song I will be playing is one of my favorite songs by Ellen Bookstel. It's called Who's the Pusher Now? Now, why am I playing that? Well, when we come back, joining me in the studio is Lauren Middleton, who's an associate attorney at the law office of Omar Figueroa, a boutique Northern California-based law firm serving the cannabis industry. So here we go with Ellen Bookstel and Who's the Pusher Now?
Background 1935, Depression. Riding high, people trying to have some fun, smoking dope and opium. Government did what they do best, making a mess, made a crime that's victimless, criminalizing cannabis. And the big drug money machine sells oxy and morphine, legal drugs get us hooked, a million deaths. Who's the pusher now? Follow the corporate money trail while decent people rot in jail. Guarantee full occupancy for private prison industry. Caught up in a living hell with a couple of million prison cells and government hypocrisy. Now. The war on drugs, a political joke, locking us up for smoking dope. No reason for doing time with a punishment when there ain't no crime. Cartels are running beer. Prohibition made it clear when you turn a market black, it's hard to turn it back. The government gets behind the gun. IRS has never done our taxes pay. The FDA so the DEA can put us away in the government drug money machine. Runs like it's on Dexedrine. Politicians legislate so they can mass incarcerate. the pusher now.
That is one of my favorite songs. Woo! Woo! Ellen Burksdale, Who's the Pusher Now? Well, welcome back. You're listening to Women's Spaces, and I'm your host, Elaine B. Holst. And without further ado, I want to introduce my guest. Joining me in the studio is Lauren Mendelson. Welcome, Lauren. Welcome to Women's Spaces.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I am, too. And don't you just love that song? You're like, Who's the Pusher Now? I mean, it's just amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, before we can begin, is it okay if I tell my listeners just a little bit about you, Lauren?
Absolutely.
Lauren Mendelson is a associate attorney at the law offices of Omar Figueroa, a boutique Northern California-based law firm serving the cannabis industry. She currently focuses on permitting and licensing for cannabis businesses, regulatory compliance, policy advocacy, and post-conviction relief. Boy, what a job you have. Lauren earned her juris... How do you say that, J.D.?
Juris doctor.
She earned it from the University of California, Irvine School of Law, and her Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Maryland. For years, Lauren has been active in the drug policy reform movement. She is the former chair of the Board of Directors of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, SSDP, an international nonprofit organization working to end the war on drugs. She currently serves on the Board of Directors for the Sonoma County Growers Alliance, a local cannabis trade organization. Well, welcome, Lauren. Welcome once again.
Thank you.
Well, Lauren, talk, you know, one of the things, you know, this is Women's Spaces, and women always like to know a little bit of history. So tell us a little background. How did you get into law, and how did you get into, you know, handling the drug experience? I mean, this, to me, it's amazing that you've even comprehended this.
Sure. Well, I, you know, the way that I got to where I am right now is kind of a windy path like we all have. You know, I grew up actually wanting to be a doctor, and I still am very passionate about science and medicine, and I think that is related to why I'm doing what I'm doing now, but it really has to do with getting involved in you know, progressive activist efforts and organizations when I was in college, in particular, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, which you mentioned, which is, you know, an international group. There's chapters around the country, and they're working to change drug policies at their campus level, state level, international level, national level. So that was my first exposure to really grassroots activism and policy work. And I found it incredibly exciting and fulfilling, and you know, it really seemed like something that I wanted to pursue, and it made me interested in maybe, you know, going to law school so that I could learn more, not just about what the laws are, but how to change the laws, how to shape laws going forward to improve situations for everyone. And so that is, you know, really the spark that made me apply to law school. While I was in law school, I kept working with SSDP and getting, you know, staying involved in drug policy reform, but also, you know, I grew up on the East Coast, and I moved to California for law school, which was something that I'd been wanting to do for a while. And so now that I was in California, there was a new possibility of doing cannabis law, not just from the criminal defense side, but from the business side as well. So that now, as a result of that, I'm now working in more of a transactional role in a cannabis law firm. And, you know, it's been really fulfilling for me. I'm both challenged by my work, but I also find it exciting. I like the clients I'm working with, and I'm you know, involved in policy work at the local and state levels.
Well, you know, what's also interesting is that you are a woman. What were some of your challenges? I mean, of all things to pick, the drug related, what were some of your early challenges that you had to overcome?
Well, I think that just, and this would probably go for any, you know, area of work, you know, women are at a disadvantage usually when it comes to men in terms of how society as a whole perceives us and perceives our ability to achieve things. And, you know, that is something that I'd been facing for throughout my whole life. I don't know if it's changed a whole lot more. The cannabis industry in many ways has a lot of men that are involved. But it also, if you actually look at it compared to other industries, there's a lot of women in high roles compared to other industries. So I think that this industry could be a place where women could really excel. And because there's no, you know, there aren't decades of knowledge that have been built up, it's not like there's any advantage that men have over women. And as a new industry, it could be a new opportunity for women to dominate. So there have been challenges, but I think that just working hard and demonstrating what you're able to accomplish, you know, throws all those out the window.
Oh, Mina, what a wonderful answer. I just really excited to know that there are women like yourself that are actually involved. It gives me a lot of confidence. Well, you know, it's really interesting. This is something that I have been very much aware of, and that is Proposition 64, which is the, isn't that the, what brought the medical marijuana to be? Is, am I correct?
So, well, medical marijuana was Prop 215 back in 96, and then Prop 64 in 2016 was adult use legalization. Yeah. And so, you know, basically marijuana is quote unquote legal for both medical and adult use here in California, but that's not really the case. I mean, there are still a number of offenses on the books involving cannabis. And so if you are doing certain things related to cannabis, it's actually not legal. So you do need to be careful and make sure that you are always fully informed of what the laws are.
Well, you know, it's really interesting to me. I have to throw this in when I think about it. I think of this plant. It's just like, to me, like a rose bush, and so much controversy around it. Well, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around 215 and 64. How are they separating the medical from the recreational? I mean, are they overlapping? Are they together? What is your opinion on that?
Well, they are separate right now. And there is going to be efforts, I think, at least in the near future, to keep them separate. And there's two, you have to look at this from two different perspectives. There's the personal use and personal cultivation side of things, and then there's the commercial side of things that need licenses from the state. And they're both divided up in terms of medical and adult use for the most part. So the licenses on the commercial side are pretty much the same, but you do need to, the products have to be in a separate track for either medical or adult use, and there's going to be, you know, different tracking associated with those two, and the state's trying to keep those chains separate, even though the products are for the most part the same. And at the personal level, there might be different limits imposed by a local jurisdiction on where you can have your adult use grow or your medical grow, or you know, the number of square footage they're allowing you for that. But they are still separate, and there's slightly different rules that apply.
Well, you know, it's real interesting. The struggle is so interesting to me, because I can't quite understand why there's such resistance and how it even got into Schedule One. I mean, it's considered the same type of thing as heroin. I mean, how do you break away from that? How do you change that?
Well, it's really tough. There are efforts at the federal level right now. There's a number of bills that would either deschedule or reschedule cannabis, take it either out of the Controlled Substances Act or move it to a lower schedule. I think that needs to happen. I mean, there, like you said, there's no reason it should be a Schedule One drug. The definition of a Schedule One drug means that it has a high potential for abuse and no potential medical value. Both of those are, neither one is true for cannabis, right? It is mildly addictive to some people, but not really, more in a physical sense than a psychological sense. And there's infinite, you know, I'm not going to say infinite, but there's a large number of medical applications that have been scientifically proven. So it doesn't make sense for it to be there. We need to keep pressuring our, you know, representatives at the federal level to make changes. And then, you know, that will help with research. The reason there has not been a lot of good research on cannabis in this country is because of how tightly it's regulated. And so that would really open the doors to a lot of things.
Well, I think people have to get over the concept of reefer madness.
Absolutely.
Well, what are some of your challenges that you're facing as a young woman and at the law firm?
Well, you know, I think just the legal industry as a whole is still very male-dominated industry, and it's very much ingrained in the culture of being a lawyer. I'm very lucky at this firm I work at. That's not the case. There is one male attorney there, my boss, but he's very much a feminist, and I don't feel like there's any pressure or whatnot, but I could easily see if I was working at a larger firm like I've worked in the past. You know, women are almost looked down upon in many corporate settings, even as a lawyer. There's a way, oftentimes, that you'd have to dress or, you know, certain ways that you'd be expected to speak. Thankfully, like I said, that's not what my experience is, but I do know people in other law firms that are experiencing that. So it's tough when you speak at an event, for example, having some of the audience maybe not feel like you're qualified. But, you know, that's less and less I'm noticing that than in the past. And I'm sure you've noticed it less throughout your life, hopefully.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Since I've been blessed that I can see the whole women's evolution. I mean, I remember one time, you know, my goal was I had to marry a doctor. I mean, when you start thinking about it, you know, we've come a long way, baby, you know. And also, you know, one of the things as I'm listening to you talk, I have to throw in one of my favorite thoughts, and that is, folks, I wish you paid as much attention to war as you do to cannabis. I mean, cannabis is not destructive, but war is, and yet we don't debate it a half as much as cannabis is being debated. And if we're so interested in protecting, you know, one of the big rules is we got to protect our children. Well, if you're so interested in protecting our children, you got to stop wars, you got to stop feeding them, educating them. Those are the important things. You know, I mean, absolutely. I don't understand how people come up with, I just had to throw this out. Well, listen, how can cannabis, you know, talk about what your biggest obstacles are right now, because one of the lines that is in that song that I love is it's hard to turn a black market white, so to speak. Mm-hmm. What is happening in the industry? How is that evolving right now?
Well, California is in a really interesting place right now where there's been a robust legal, not semi-legal, medical marijuana industry operating in this gray area for, you know, two decades, let's say. And they developed their own standards to a sense, and now there's this new regulations, new laws, new licenses that have to be obtained. And there's two steps involved. You need to get a local permit before you can get a state license. That's the way the law is written. So now you have to add in all of your local rules and regulations. Your city, your county, are they giving out a permit for this? How much are they going to charge you? How long is it going to take? And so when you add the local, you know, having to pay attention to what's happening locally in addition to the new laws and regulations at the state level, adding in all of the fines for licensing, application, it's a lot for a lot of people who haven't had to deal with this before to have to deal with, and they're not oftentimes given a large time frame to do so. So it's challenging. I mean, you have to remember a lot of people that were cannabis operators were either off the grid or they were doing this because they didn't want to deal with the traditional business. At least some of them were. And now, you know, most of them probably weren't business majors, let's say. And now all of a sudden we're putting this person in a circumstance where they have to be a business operator.
Can I ask you something? You know, as I read everything, and I've been listening to, when I listen to the television a lot, they're doing a lot more advertising with hard liquor, you know, gin, mm-hmm. and you know, the Cutty Sark, stuff like that. Do they have the same regulations? I mean, do they have to go through the same steps? I mean, here we have the wine industry here in Sonoma County. Do they have to go through all this rigmarole in order to grow wine grapes?
You know, I don't want to speak to what is required for vineyards because I don't really know, but I do know that there are at least more requirements on cannabis operators than on other types of farmers. I don't know exactly how much more, but when you add in all of the different layers, it's definitely very difficult to start this up. And there's standards that aren't necessarily, you know, fair across the board when you compare one standard that's imposed on this industry that's not necessarily imposed on another agricultural industry. I mean, cannabis, it's a plant, like you said, right? And it's defined in state laws as an agricultural product. And, you know, with the exception of some security measures that have to be in place, it shouldn't be treated that much differently than other agricultural commodities.
Yeah, I know. It's mind-boggling to me when I start thinking about it. Well, you know, recently there's more research showing a correlation between access to cannabis and decreased opioid use. And, you know, know, that right now that's a big problem in our country. I mean, I can't believe what I'm hearing. So, in they're doing all these different laws. Are they going to tax, you know, pain pills and all the different things? What is that, a myth or is that true?
There's actually been a lot of studies that have showed both a decrease in opioid overdoses in states that have legalized medical or recreational cannabis, as well as a decrease in the number of opiates being prescribed in those states. So there is scientific evidence backing this up, and I think it makes sense. There was just a special actually last night on CNN. Dr. Sanjay Gupta did an in-depth thing about specifically the use of cannabis to treat people with opioid addiction. And when you look at the neuroscience behind it, it makes a lot of sense as to why it might help people stop using opioids. It has pain relief effects, and it also impacts the part of the brain that has to do with impulsive behaviors and addiction. So it's really quite fascinating. Just another example of the medical applications that cannabis does have. And if you look at the relative harm of opioids versus cannabis, you can have an overdose from opioids relatively easy. You could take too many and fall asleep and not wake up because you forgot to breathe. That's never happened from anyone taking cannabis. So I think it's quite hypocritical that we have the current policies the way they are, where it's fully legal for doctors to prescribe things that could kill you and not to allow something that has never killed anyone.
Well, it's just like all wars are fought in the name of peace. When you start thinking about it, I mean, there's so many contradictions. You know. I want to tell my listeners that I asked my guest always to send me five questions, and I found one of your questions very, very interesting, that you grew up on the East Coast, and how are things different? You know, I guess, is there a comparison between California? I mean, I think California is one of the most liberal states in the whole United States. So what's the difference? What are some of your challenges that you would have if you were back east, say, versus here in California?
Well, things are thankfully changing everywhere across the country, but slower in some places than others. And there's a number of states where cannabis is completely prohibited still for both medical and adult use. And there's a lot of states where it's somewhere in the middle, and there's a few states like California where it's, like you said, very progressive, very liberal. I was in college in Maryland, and it's when I first started using cannabis, and it was helping me with my anxiety. I was prescribed Xanax at the time, and I didn't want to take my Xanax. I wanted to use this, you know, herbal medicine instead. And I was in an encounter with the police one time, and I almost got arrested. My friends ended up getting arrested. I could have gone to jail for a year for 1 gram of marijuana, $20 worth. And, you know, had that happened in California, nothing would have happened. Maybe I would have gotten a ticket. They would have probably just told me to go home. And that's just one example of how drastically different the exact same behavior is treated here and there. And, you know, over there, being a college student at the time, had I been arrested, I could have lost my scholarship. I would have lost my student housing. It would have changed the whole trajectory of my life.
Young people are arrested under, they get a felony. I mean, right now we're having an election, and I've been going around trying to support a candidate, and I've been asking people, are you registered to vote? I can't believe how many people are telling me no because they're felons. And I say, oh, you're a felon? And what happened? Marijuana arrest. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. Well, I want to go into another one of my pet peeves, and that is everybody with the smell. It smells. You know, I feel like going to the city councils and the board of supervisors and bringing some, maybe arugula or even a bunch of roses. You know, is this going to become illegal? How can people overcome these stigmas and start living together and cooperating together? I mean, I realize there has been some criminal activity, but people have to recognize whenever there's a prohibition, there's always criminal activity. Mm-hmm. So how can neighbors, you know, a lot of scenes I read in the Sonoma County Gazette, not in my door or not in my neighborhood. How can people start coming together a little bit more on this? What are some of the suggestions you have?
That's a great question. I think that we have to have dialogue within the community, and that doesn't just mean I write an angry letter to the editor and you write an angry letter in response, because that's not actually communicating with each other, right? And so having forums where neighbors can meet other neighbors, where people can dispel the, you know, common myths about cannabis operators, or maybe they'll learn why their neighbor is so against it. Maybe they have a legitimate reason, whatever that is. And I think there's legitimate arguments on both sides. I know there are. And so there has to be a middle ground where people can still be allowed to enjoy their house and feel like they're not having something forced upon them, but other people who've been, you know, members of that same community for years can feel like they can do what they have the right to do and grow this plant without bothering anyone. So I think it's tricky, but dialogue is really what's going to help, and getting to know other people, getting to know, you know, the other. We're always afraid of the other because we don't know it. So once you know it and it becomes familiar, chances are there will be, you know, bridges will be made. And so I think that's really important. When it comes to the smell, that's a tough one. You know, there's, when you have an outdoor crop, it's hard to mitigate the smell. There's ways to do it if you're inside or in a greenhouse. But it all has to do, like you say, about perspective, placement of the farm, and maybe just talking to your neighbors. And I think that there's plenty of uses. You mentioned roses and arugula, but, you know, think about all the dairy farms and the other types of animal farms that are in this county, too.
Oh, my goodness. Well, my friend, we are coming to the end of this segment. Can you, and you know, what a delightful interview, and I really have to compliment you. I heard you on the air on another program, and I thought, wow, I'm so lucky to have you on my program, and you were just really marvelous as in explaining and talking about this very, very sensitive issue. So give us a website and any other information that you would like to end with.
Sure. Well, if you'd like to learn more about my law firm, you can go to www.omarfigueroa.com. And I'd also encourage you to learn more about the Sonoma County Growers Alliance, which is the local cannabis trade association. Their website is scgalliance.com, I believe. And they meet once a month. They've got networking mixers. You can come meet other members of the industry, or if you're looking to get into the industry, or if you just want to meet your neighbors and have some of that dialogue we talked about.
Well, thank you so much, Laura Mendelson, for being such a great guest.
Thank you.
Well,
again,
a special thank you to Francisco Carranza and also to Laura Mendelson for being such great guests. You've been listening to Women's Spaces. I'm your host, Elaine B. Holtz, and I look forward to being with you the next time.
The woman in your life.